It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Plans are moving forward on a billion-dollar makeover of Pittsburgh International Airport, and we got a first glimpse yesterday. The new passenger-friendly terminal will be built adjacent to the current airside facility between concourses C and D. It's scheduled to open in 2023. Early mock-ups lean heavily on nature. We are joined by Christina Casota, CEO of the Allegheny County Airport Authority. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And on the line is Luis Vidal, founder and executive president of Luis Vidal and Architects, who helped create the designs over the last many months. Luis, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you.
So, Christine, I want to start with you. Is it fair to say that the early 90s Pittsburgh International was built for U.S. Airways because it was a hub?
I think that it's fair to say that that was the overriding element of design that influenced why we have the facility we have today. Some of that has been very good for us and will last, and some of it needs to be replaced.
So who is this new terminal being built for? To both
Pittsburgh.
Of you.
Pittsburgh. People coming into or departing from Pittsburgh. People who are visiting Pittsburgh, people who live here and want to take a trip and then come home. It really is very much for the person, the family, the group that has Pittsburgh as its origin or destination, as opposed to its through transit space.
It is the front door to this region. And therefore, one has to remember that it has to resemble the region. So we're really designing this for everyone to enjoy. We would love also the community to embrace the terminal and use it throughout the week or weekend, not only just as a passenger, but also to come and enjoy all the amenities and the different things that we're going to have here, including, for example, an observation deck. Mm-hmm. We're going to recuperate the idea of having a landscape of observation deck where people can come and enjoy on an outdoor space watching the movement of planes.
Many people got their first experiences of airports. Maybe their parents took them to the airport to watch planes take off and land. And so you're bringing back an old feature into a more modern terminal.
That is correct. And we are sure it's going to be very welcoming.
Christina, the images are on our website from the design, but for listeners, why don't you give us a picture of what it will look like for people who are used to that current X-shaped airside terminal?
Well, there will still be an X-shaped airside terminal. That will be remaining. It was brilliantly designed back when it opened in 1992. Its architect, Tasso Katselis, did a great job in allowing for the easy transit of passengers among gates, in between gates. So that works really well for us. That center core is a phenomenal feature, especially after we've added that dramatic floor to the core. But you don't necessarily get to appreciate it when you're coming up, right, two levels from the train. So what you will get is, if you can think about the experience of coming through the Fort Pitt Tunnel, and this is one that Luis has referenced and certainly I experienced as a newcomer to Pittsburgh, is the first time I'm coming through the Fort Pitt Tunnel and then boom, here's this amazing panorama in front of you, right? And Luis can talk a little bit about the design elements of that. But what we expect is that the new terminal will be integrated nicely into our existing airside core and will allow for passengers departing to come out of security and then into this amazing open space that is the airside core, looking at it from above, and then very easily being able to figure out where they're going quickly. One of the things that we find today is that people come up from the train and then stop because they don't know where they're going. Mm. So there are a lot of other reasons for doing this design, but one of the features that we're most excited about is just the ability to capture what I think is essentially a Pittsburgh experience in terms of ability to be influenced by the space.
Luis, how do you blend functionality, convenience, and appearance?
Well, the building must be very functional. I mean, that's the first must. So therefore, in this case, we're having a level for departing passengers and a level below for arriving passengers. So people move at grade and don't need to change vertically. But at the same time, the building is surrounded by nature, And it's like being the inside, having the inside out and bringing the outside in. So it's like, imagine a pavilion in the middle of a forest. And then the roof is like a rolling curve. It's like, you know, the rolling mountains of Pittsburgh, the rolling bridges. It's all about the movement and generating that experience of compression and expansion that you find, as Christina was describing, when you go into and out of the Fort Pitt Tunnel. Or you find the masterpieces in the region, like in Falling Water. And it's also introducing a number of other factors. It's giving us the opportunity of introducing natural local materials like wood, and also expressing the building structure to evoke trees.
Right. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're speaking with Christina Casota, CEO of the Airport Authority, and with architect Luis Vidal about the new design for the new terminal that was unveiled yesterday. Christina, I wanted to touch upon quickly some of the new features. So separate levels for departing and arriving passengers, additional space for TSA checkpoints, shorter walking distances. Why are those key components of the overall functionality?
Well, anything that improves the passenger experience and allows for passengers to experience less stress when they are traveling is important. We find that until people get through security and get near the gate or know where their gate is, that there is a level of anxiety that is not good for people. And so we are looking to find opportunities to make sure that people can choose how they want to experience the airport. Do they want to move through it quickly? Do they want to stop and shop or dine or work? What do they want to do in the space? And what we've done is created a space, or what the designers have done, excuse me, is created a space where people have the freedom to make those choices and to have the kind of space that they can really truly feel like they're part of the Pittsburgh community and they are surrounded by what makes Pittsburgh so great, its DNA, its nature, the technology, the sense of community, which Luis has coined the phrase of Nateco by taking the first couple of letters from each word. This is really guiding the design and really adding to enhancing the passenger experience, which makes for a more pleasant journey for everybody and helps us to lead the industry in what we think is an important next step for considering the essential users of the airport, the employees as well as the passengers.
But let's face it, right now it's a bit of a haul from where you park your car to the time you get to your gate for your flight. Will it be a shorter distance?
Yes, it will. And you can see that in the design. I mean, first of all, just by eliminating the train, you're already eliminating the distance. And so this is in line with what people experience at a lot of other airports, which is when you get into the departures hall, you walk through security and you are in fact post security, your landside. You don't have to take a train. You don't have to take a long walkway. It's a pretty quick experience if that's what you want. And if you want to be able to linger and experience more of the airport in certain spaces, which I think the team has done really well with, especially with the outdoor space that's available, then you can do that.
The Airport Authority just paid off the last renovation from the early 90s, the actual new Pittsburgh International at that time. Mm-hmm. You said the taxpayers won't directly fund this new renovation, but passengers will pay a portion through regular travel. So why put the Airport Authority, why put Pittsburgh back in debt? What's the upside?
Let's talk about how airports are financed in this country. Airports are financed through airline fees and user-generated fees. So a portion of what you pay to park, a portion of what you pay for your McDonald's cheeseburger, a portion of what you pay for the magazine at Hudson News or Rite Aid. That's how airports in this country are financed. And we also get a lot of grants from the FAA in order to maintain our airfield because it's very, very expensive to take care of all that pavement out there. In exchange, the FAA says, okay, you in exchange must keep all airport revenue on the airport, period, end of sentence. You don't get to spend it in the community. It must stay on the airport. If we, the federal government, are going to invest in your facility, you as an operator must take your earnings and invest them back in the facility as well.
Right.
So the fact is, We have got to fix this landside building, or we have to build a new one. Those are our choices. This building is aging. It has systems that are approaching end of life. We have to make a decision. We think that it makes a lot more sense to start over. So we're taking on the kind of debt that is the right kind of debt. It's an investment in our future, and we're confident that it's the right thing to do.
Okay. Louise, final quick question to you. The airlines want passengers to have a good, safe flight. When the new terminal is completed, what do you want the passenger experience to be?
Well, we want the passenger experience to be similar, you know, from the moment they leave home until the moment they touch their destination. It's a stressful journey. So everything we can do in that journey to alleviate and to improve their experience, that's our goal.
And Christina, the projected timetable, 2023?
2023. We'll cut a ribbon.
Christina Kasotis, the CEO of the Allegheny County Airport Authority. Luis Vidal, founder and executive president of Luis Vidal and Architects, who helped create the design over the last several months. Thanks so much for joining us on The Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gammon. You are listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
They say a journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, or, in the case of Paul Mahoney, one record. Jezebel. Frankie Lane's 1951 recording of Jezebel was the first record that Paul Mahoney ever bought. He opened Recordrama in Pittsburgh at the urging of his wife, and his collection would grow exponentially through the years, becoming the world's largest by the time he tried to sell it on eBay on this day in 2008. The winning bid was a bust, but Mahoney eventually unloaded all those records to a collector in Brazil in 2013. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
Oil and gas waste is high in salt and radioactive material. Ohio wants to make it easier to spread it on its roads. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. Conventional oil and gas wastewater is really cheap and really high in salt. For years, municipalities in Pennsylvania and Ohio have used it on roads to suppress dust or melt ice. A Penn State study from last year found this waste was high in radioactive materials, and spreading it on roads could pollute soil, water, and even the air. One Ohio company has been processing this waste into what it calls a purified product. But an Ohio government report finds this de-icer has high amounts of radium. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that Ohio lawmakers are considering loosening regulations on the product anyway.
Ohio-based Nature Zone Source has been making the de-icer Aqua Selena for years. It's been sold to retailers, schools, and local governments because it works well when it gets really cold outside, like below 10 degrees.
I've gotten reports from cities that say it's actually saved them a ton of money.
That's Ohio State Senator Matt Dolan.
It used to take 4 or 5 hours of manpower to clean the sidewalks in cities. Now it takes significantly less.
The company recycles brine water from conventional oil and gas wells, not fracked wells, and sells it as de-icer. In Pennsylvania, Aqua Selena is an approved product for use by the State Department of Transportation, although a spokesperson says they don't use it. On the other hand, the Ohio Department of Transportation says it used 1 million gallons of Aqua Selena last winter. Dolan says it does more than just melt ice. It also uses a waste product that's in abundance.
Natural brine water, which is in and of itself a problem. And if we can make it more safe, more applicable, create jobs in the meantime, use technology and innovation, we should do that.
Dolan is considering reintroducing a bill he sponsored last year that never got a vote in the Ohio Senate. It would loosen regulations on Aqua Selena. But ever since an environmental group got a copy of an unreleased report by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources last summer, concerns have been growing about the product. ODNR tested 14 samples of Aqua Selena and found levels of radioactivity that exceeded state limits for drinking water and the environment.
Do you really need to have a product that might contain that kind of threat to your health.
Trish Demeter is with the Ohio Environmental Council. She's concerned that if state legislation reducing regulations on aqua salina is introduced again this session as expected, more people will be spraying it onto sidewalks, driveways, and roads.
There could be a product out there on the shelves available to any Ohioan to use that could potentially have elevated levels of heavy metals and radioactive material.
Demeter says people use de-icers repeatedly each winter, so the radiation and heavy metals found in aqua salina could build up in the environment, elevating health concerns like cancer. But Senator Dolan and other lawmakers question the validity of the ODNR report. He says he'll review a variety of studies about aqua salina before deciding whether to reintroduce his bill. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
There's more on this issue, including a link to that Penn State report I mentioned earlier, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection. We Shall Not Be Moved is a traditional spiritual song that became very popular during protests and marches of the civil rights movement. The song began as I Shall Not Be Moved, as heard here in an early recording of it from 1929 by pioneering Delta blues musician Charlie Patton. The original spiritual was much more explicitly religious. The Australian folk pop group The Seekers recorded a 1965 version in this early tradition. On our way to heaven, we shall not be moved. In the 1930s, striking coal miners adapted the song into We Shall Not Be Moved, similar to the transition that the song We Shall Overcome made from a hymn to a labor anthem. And from there, it was adopted by civil rights protesters. During the attempts to march from Selma to Montgomery in Alabama in 1965, marchers sang We Shall Not Be Moved by police barricades. The protesters updated the lyrics for the specific circumstances, as can be heard on this recording from March 15, 1965. We shall not be moved. Yes, I'm alive. Ann Mavis Staples commemorated We Shall Not Be Moved on her 2007 album of songs from the civil rights movement, We'll Never Turn Back. Just like a tree that's planted by the wall, we shall not be moved. For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to our website at wyep.org/Black History Month.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Spring training gets into full swing for the Pirates this weekend. And in 1960, the same year the Bucks won their third World Series title, an athletic league was making a name for itself in the city. As part of our series on women in Pittsburgh history, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the legacy of Mildred Allen.
In the living room of her Verona home, Beatrice Allen Harper recounts what it was like when her mother, Mildred, ran one of the largest community athletic organizations in Pittsburgh, the Tri-Borough Softball League. Harper says her mother loved sports. She played second base on the softball team and participated in volleyball tournaments and has the medals to prove it.
You want to see them?
Sure.
Okay, wait a minute.
Harper spreads out 8 small gold and silver medals. Tiny images of women playing sports are imprinted on the bottom, and the City of Pittsburgh coat of arms is engraved on the top.
See, all the gold is champs, that one silver one that was runner-up.
Harper's mother won a lot of these medals, and she channeled her love of sports into creating the Triborough League for Women. Dozens of teams from the Hill District to the North Side to McKeesport joined. There were Allen's team, the Hill District Satellites, the Garfieldettes, and the Homewood Orbits. Each year, Harper says, the organization's reputation grew.
Well, she'd be getting calls, okay, when the season get ready to start, maybe in the springtime. They said, well, Miss Allen, we got a team. We want to know if we can join your league. And it was like the word of mouth, and people start calling her up and all.
Harper says at any given time across the city's fields during softball season, someone would be practicing. As a coach and a commissioner, Harper says her mother had high expectations of her players.
You know, like, and if somebody messed up, she just cuss us out and make us do it right, you know?
Around the same time, the civil rights movement was in full swing, and the Triborough League provided an outlet for Black women who were struggling for equal rights. In the 1970s, a group called the United Black Front sponsored Allen's team, the Satellites. Heinz History Center Director of African American Program Samuel Black says the organization was a cultural nationalist group that held outreach activities, fought for civil rights, and created economic development plans.
United Black Front were just trying to improve the living conditions of the community and provide not only education, but real life enrichment activities for the youth of the community.
Under Allen's leadership, the Triborough League thrived. They went on trips to Canada and Ohio to give players an opportunity to see more of the world. Black says the leagues were filled with multi-generational players.
You had women with gray hair on that baseball team, and then some who looked like they were no more than 15 or 16 years old.
The league disbanded in 1976. By that time, Allen's Satellites had won a handful of championships. The federal Title IX legislation had recently passed, requiring funding be allocated equally for men and women's athletics and educational programs. Black says in the years the Triborough teams played in Pittsburgh, they were an important outlet for communities still struggling for equality.
So I think that type of impact, showing that, you know, this is something that can be done, this is something that the community wanted, they followed through on it, and it lasted for nearly two decades.
Allen's uniform and memorabilia from the Triborough Softball League are on display in the Western Pennsylvania Sports Museum. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Next month, local digital news organization PublicSource.org is launching Developing Pittsburgh, a new initiative dedicated to covering the ins and outs of urban development and the importance of design and planning for the health of the city. The Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski sat down with Public Source editor Jeffrey Benzing and their new reporter, Tom Lisi, to talk about the initiative.
So Public Source is already covering stories focused on economic and urban development. Why is a dedicated effort important with a new reporter?
Well, for one thing, we found that those stories were among our most popular. So when we were kind of doing our deep dives into issues like affordable housing or things like inclusionary zoning, we really saw that there was a lot of response from readers for wanting not just more stories, but to understand more about how the processes work and the way that the city is changing and has changed over the past couple years, we just think is something that is crucial for folks to understand and feel like they're a part of it.
So now that Developing Pittsburgh is its own sort of independent section of Public Source, will that change the strategy for reporting on these topics in any way?
I think folks can definitely expect to see more of us. We're going to have a really regular presence. So in terms of maybe in contrast to doing a story that we would report over several weeks and then have a big kind of deep dive into a topic, not having that just be saved for a story down the line, but really saying, here's what you need to know now and here's how you can get involved and understand things better.
So, Tom, you've spent a lot of time reporting on public affairs in places like New York and Illinois. Are stories in those markets comparable to a city like Pittsburgh?
Definitely. I was just in a city in central Illinois, Decatur, Illinois. They're really grappling with a lot of similar issues that Pittsburgh is. There is, of course, this whole new element in Pittsburgh of new investment coming into the city. So obviously that has a lot of different repercussions that a more struggling city doesn't have.
So being new to the area, how familiar are you with Pittsburgh and the nuances in economic development here over the last decade or so?
Well, not very. I rolled into town a few weeks ago, so it's just kind of starting from scratch with a blank canvas. But, you know, as you start a new job, you eventually get the hang of it. So,
Jeff, do you think this outsider perspective is a strength in a way?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think having Tom be new in our newsroom, which is fairly small, we all kind of stay very busy on our own projects, but he's bringing in fresh eyes to the city. I think it's beneficial to have that new perspective. And I think Tom's experience in Decatur, he's also bringing in things that he learned as a reporter there and learning to talk to people that he can now apply to the new beat as you're developing sources and figuring out you know, maybe people who haven't been quoted a thousand times in other development stories, you know, he's going to be making those connections on his own and hopefully have fresh faces and a diversity of who gets to be included in this types of reporting.
So there have been major developments all across the city, from the north side to Station Square and the produce terminal in the Strip District. Where are you guys going to focus your efforts first?
Well, my kind of first piece for Public Source is kind of going to be looking at five areas of the city. So you mentioned just a bunch of them, North Side, South Side, Strip District, Hill District, and East Liberty. Obviously, there's quite a few of those that have been written about a lot and a lot of Pittsburgh residents are very familiar with. And then there will be some aspects of those stories, developments that maybe people don't know about, or maybe some perspectives that people don't know about, and just kind of going from there.
Will all of or the bulk of your reporting focus on development strictly within city limits?
No, I don't think so. I think we might, for the first bit of time, focus a little bit more closely on the city, but obviously the way the regional economy is changing and the way cities in America are changing, that has enormous repercussions for the surrounding area.
And I think, too, when we're looking at issues like affordable housing and who gets to stay in a neighborhood as it's redeveloping, one of the key storylines that has been reported on already, of course, is the push out to surrounding areas that are outside the city. You know, what happens with an influx of residents into the Mon Valley, for instance, who identify as City of Pittsburgh residents, although now they're seeking rents that they can maybe better afford. And looking at those changes is going to be something that is going to be really important. And really seeing it as what happens in the City of Pittsburgh is really closely linked to just what goes on regionally as well.
So this page isn't starting completely from scratch. You've included a number of previously published articles under the Developing Pittsburgh tag, and one of those stories is a profile of the Urban Redevelopment Authority, what it is, what it does. Can we expect more deep dives like this about the inner workings of authorities in Pittsburgh?
I think absolutely. We already have a couple in mind and things that are planned. And as I was saying at the beginning, the idea is really kind of to demystify these things. You know, I think if you care about what your neighborhood looks like, you know, maybe you don't know what all the acronyms are or what all the policy machinations are, but you certainly care how they work. And we see our role. And I think Tom can be a great asset there. And just, you know, explaining it to regular folks and also opening it up so it's a transparent process.
Jeff, so Public Source has been asking people to submit their thoughts about how Pittsburgh has been changing and how it's going to continue to change over the next 10 to 20 years. What have the responses been like so far?
Well, we're still seeking them. I've heard a couple interesting ideas, more kind of thinking like, here are people you should talk to or things that you should look into, which is great for developing our story list and the things that are going to inform what the page looks like. But we're still really interested in having folks submit them. So if there are folks out there listening who, you know, you don't have to be an artistic genius or anything, but if you have feelings about what change looks like in your neighborhood and how it impacts you, and, you know, maybe you like to sketch or you know, do a little bit of free writing or something, we'd love to see what you have and see if it's something that we could put up on the webpage.
Tom, your first piece is going to be published the first week of March. Can you tell us a little bit about the story you're working on?
Yeah, it's a sort of look at five neighborhoods that are experiencing quite a bit of private development, and some of that is with public help through various public entities. But it's just kind of a look at what those developments potentially mean for those communities and the kind of debate going on about, you know, development is great, but what kind of development do we want? And, you know, so I think that's something that, like a lot of other cities, Pittsburgh is sort of really starting to grapple with. So it'll just be kind of looking at that from the lens of about five neighborhoods in town.
You can check out the stories and find out more about Developing Pittsburgh at publicsource.org. Tom Lisi and Jeff Benzing with Public Source, thank you both for talking to us today, and we look forward to reading these important stories.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Over the next few days in Vatican City, Pope Francis is meeting with bishops from around the world to address the clergy sexual abuse scandal in Pennsylvania diocese, as well as in other states and countries. On the line from Atlanta is Susan Bigelow Reynolds. She's an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. Welcome to the Confluence.
Glad to be here, Kevin.
Susan, you wrote an open letter, sent it to the president and vice president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, as well as the papal nuncio, the Pope's envoy, shortly after the Pennsylvania grand jury report was released. The letter was calling for change and addressing this issue. Thousands signed the letter. Did you ever get a response?
You know, both surprisingly and unsurprisingly, we did not. It was surprising because of the magnitude of the response to the letter. It was covered very widely in the media, and it included the signatures of over 6,200 Catholics from all over the country and the world. And we never received a formal response.
The gathering kicked off today. What are you expecting to hear?
You know, everything I've seen indicates that the desired outcome of this summit will be some kind of global procedural reforms that are put in place for the protection of minors and, the reporting of priests and bishops who are complicit in abuse. Procedural reforms are very, very important, and I do hope that that is one outcome. But if we're going to address abuse in the church, I think new policies and procedures aren't enough. What's needed is a cultural and a structural transformation in the church that gets at the very heart of how power operates, how gender and sexuality are understood, how authority is understood, how seminarians are trained. Mm-hmm. You know, I think until we begin to address and dismantle this culture of clericalism in the church that's at the heart of this crisis, these wounds can't begin to heal.
You mentioned policy, procedure. Are you looking for a third P in terms of change, personnel? In other words, a shakeup of leadership?
A shakeup of leadership, I suppose, but you can't simply put new people in the same structure and expect them to behave differently. Mm-hmm. I think we need something that's even deeper than that. It's different than just switching out the guys who are there. We need to really consider how a culture of clericalism and secrecy has contributed to the kind of church where the protection of perpetrators has been made a priority rather than truth and repentance and healing for victims. We've seen this even when victims have come forward with their stories and have been made to feel in some ways that they're the victimizers of the church, that by telling the truth about what's happened to them, somehow they are they're violating the holiness of the church, or that they're speaking out, harms the church in some way. They've been made to feel as though they're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an indication that what's at stake here isn't just a lack of procedures. It's something much deeper. It's a culture of clericalism.
Do you think that any of the six leaders, the leaders of the six dioceses in Pennsylvania, should feel apprehensive about their status?
All leaders. it's hard to know what the sort of concrete changes that are going to come out of this are going to be, particularly vis-a-vis Pennsylvania per se. Here in the U.S., the grand jury report out of Pennsylvania brought this once again to the attention of U.S. Catholics. But it's important to note that this is a global gathering, which is important. It signals to the world that the abuse crisis is in some way not just a U.S. problem or a Western problem, as it has sometimes been painted, but rather it's a global crisis affecting the entire church. At the same time, the global nature of the summit also means that what we're going to see from the bishops who are gathered there is a lot of different and sometimes competing cultural values and understandings of the nature of this crisis. So while in the U.S., it's very evident to most Catholics here this is a catastrophic crisis that, goes well beyond a few bad apples, there are still bishops in parts of the world who deny that sexual abuse is a problem where they live. It's not a problem in my diocese. It's not a problem in my country. There are some that acknowledge it's a problem, but blame it on homosexuality or the sexual revolution or a simple lack of commitment to chastity. You know, some bishops from certain parts of the world acknowledge that there is a problem, but they have very different ways, culturally conditioned, very different ways of thinking about what accountability or punishment means in those cases. So I think those calls for U.S. Catholics to sort of moderate our expectations of what's going to come out of this isn't so much a factor of the idea that Francis doesn't recognize the urgency of this moment, but rather I think it's a recognition that this is a global gathering and we're going to see lots of very different and competing cultural values at play. So it's hard to know what the concrete outcome at the local level is going to be.
Right. Cultural values you mentioned, of course, they can vary from country to country, continent to continent. But isn't the Catholic Church worldwide, don't they see a universal value, valuing and protecting children?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. But the way in which that gets implemented at local levels is highly contingent on local cultures. A lot of the ways in which power and leadership is exercised in the church in some way mirrors the way in which power and leadership is exercised in other venues, in particular cultures. We've seen this in some ways in a not the same, but a related way in the recent revelations of this sort of scourge of the sexual abuse of nuns in various parts of the world. And what you've seen there are, again, a lot of different and very culturally conditioned understandings of what accountability means, gender roles, what, you know, people's approaches to the vow of chastity. And again, I think even in many parts of the country or in parts of the world, even where there's an acknowledgement that there is a problem, sometimes the automatic response to that problem isn't jail time. You know, it's a different way of dealing with a problem in a community. So I think, again, it's there's a recognition that sexual abuse of children and vulnerable adults is a bad thing. I don't think anybody would dispute that. I think what's going to be in question is, well, what is, what does this mean for my particular context?
Right. Just a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you, 3 weeks ago, Pope Francis said expectations for the summit should be, quote, deflated. Do you think that's what Catholics wanted to hear? What abuse survivors in Pennsylvania and elsewhere wanted to hear?
Absolutely not. I think that was deflating. That caused a lot of outcry. At the same time, I think, he said that, I think for the reason that I mentioned, that this is a global gathering. And we can't expect everybody there to be on the same page about the extent to which this is happening in their diocese and the extent to which, what to do about it. At the same time, I have been gently heartened by the way in which at this gathering, at the summit that's going on currently, the voices of victims have been foregrounded in a particular way. So a group from the Vatican heard the testimony of survivors yesterday before the summit began. And then even today, which was the first day of the summit, the theme was responsibility, interspersed throughout the various interventions offered by archbishops and cardinals, there were three of them, were testimonies read from victims that were very, of course, just powerful and wrenching. I read a headline in a Catholic publication earlier this morning that said something to the effect that victims were stealing the show at this summit, which I think is a completely wrong way of looking at it. They're not stealing the show, right? This is their show. This is all about the victims. And I think that at least the attempt that's been made to really prioritize the voices and experience of the victims is something that is important and heartening in some way.
Susan Bigelow Reynolds is an assistant professor of Catholic Studies at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.